Kay Morris, and this is the KM Lobby. We're here to help you find out more and discover what's going on in the world of knowledge management. I'm joined by Monica Denise Perrin, based out of England, and Janetta Guelli, out of Italy. Together, we are here to explore the world of knowledge management. Your company or organization would like to help us continue this mission and sponsor one of our shows, email BYNTK at pioneer-ks.org. Edwin K. Morris here with another exciting episode of the KM Lobby. I am Edwin K. Morris, and I'm here in sunny Florida. Janetta and then Monica, please introduce where you are and who you are.
Good morning, everybody, or good afternoon, or good evening. This is Janetta Guelli from Italy, actually working from Belgium as a senior knowledge manager, and I'm the executive producer of this show. So welcome, everybody, and thank you for listening, but especially to our guest, Annette.
Monica, I just want to make sure everyone knows Monica is on sick leave with her foot in the air, calling in from her
boudoir
abode because she has had surgery, but she is a trooper and she is a KM passionate. Thank you.
I'm a soldier, Edwin. I'm a KM soldier and I wouldn't miss this for the world. And I don't have trench foot. We digress. I wouldn't miss this for the world. Hello, my name's Monica. I know I'm a knowledge manager. I've been one for 24 years or more. I'm not showing my age. And I'm head of KM for a company called Emergen and loving every second of it. And also loving our guest, Annette Corbett, who I can't wait that we start talking to, as she's very knowledgeable about KM.
Thank you. KM Lobby is ready to roll with our special guest today of this incredible edition with Annette Corbett. Annette, tell me something I don't know.
Oh, I eat cheese and crisp sandwiches.
Do you put any mustard on that? Any mustard?
Absolutely not. Oh. Why?
Okay. Now, on a serious note, where are you on the planet and how did you fall into KM?
So I'm based in Essex, just outside London, and I fell into KM through working at a law firm called Ashurst. I joined as a legal secretary. That's how I started my profession, and I worked for head of knowledge management, prior to which I'd never heard of knowledge management and had no idea what it involved, just that my manager's office was full of files and paper, and she always looked very in the zone. As part of that role, I started working on the internet, so managing the Bank of Precedence online. And that was my first sort of internet experience as well. So
you were kind of sideways brought into the knowledge management stream.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
What was the thing that gave you some guidance? What was the flagpole you went to? What was the source that helped you understand what it was and how it was supposed to look?
No one explained it. That would be one thing worth mentioning. No one explained it. This is knowledge management. This is what it means. That was something I figured out by proxy, by working for someone who is so super organized and granular in the detail. And that's pretty much the theme with anyone that I've worked with in KM. They're very much about the detail that no one thinks about. And literally, you don't think about it. Yeah, I kind of learned that as I went along, but it took some years.
So what was the one manuscript that gave you the start?
How do you mean exactly?
Was there a textbook? Was there a workshop you took? What was the one thing that kind of helped formulate your pathway forward?
I would say LinkedIn as, you know, as a tool for connecting with people who kind of produce content on that so you can learn, because the books were, I love a book, I do love a good book, but I don't like a fusty old textbook, and all the kind of KM books were just dry, just utterly dry. And so I found that following people on LinkedIn who were sort of associated with KM really was the difference.
So it was the KM community, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a very nascent community as well. So you get to know people and almost like colleagues and peers for life, aren't they? Because it's such a small community.
Janetta, would you like to jump in?
I think because normally we say that KM makes communities, so making connection. So probably this is why you fall in love with KM, maybe Making connection is part of your personality. What do you think?
It's yeah, definitely. But it's a bit of an oxymoron because KM is about organizing, and I am the most, my brain is just an absolute.
Wait a minute, wait a minute, wait a minute. Anything that got you to where you are? I just wanted to know if there's any formal anything behind your achievements.
No, it's all about hustling and talking to people and jobs, work. Work is it. Contracting is it's the gift. You do contracting and you have to fly by the seat of your pants a bit. It's a baptism of fire. There are things you will learn. There'll be things you're expected to know and you won't have a clue. So you need a good game face and you need to be able to learn quickly. And that's really how I've developed, I guess, my understanding of KM. And it's definitely served me really well, the whole contracting gig.
So would you think, Annette, that having a degree in knowledge management or a sort of specialization does make you any plus for getting a job in knowledge management? Because everything is personality and attitude in a positive way. Or do you think that in a certain way, knowledge management can be learned by following a specific master degree or any certification, whatever, because in our community, there are some people who are pushing even senior or seasoned knowledge managers to take a certification knowledge management. But what is knowledge management really about? Is it really connected to a degree or something else? What do you think about this?
I think it would be the only sort of formal qualification I'm aware of is the KM Chartership, which is run by an organizing,
Through Philip.
Philip, exactly. And that's the only one that I'm aware of, certainly in the UK. I think it would be helpful because I'm going to sound a bit controversial here, but I do think KM is very much a club. But I think senior people in KM are quite, they like a very traditional path, someone with information management sort of qualifications. And I don't come from that background at all. And when I open my mouth, I don't talk like anyone that comes from that background because I think there's a type of person that is accepted as being a proper kind of KM professional. And I don't mean that to sound that the industry isn't welcoming, but I think there are perceptions about the standard to which you must rise, to be called a KM professional. Is that unfair? Is that harsh? I don't
Well,
know.
I don't think so. I mean, traditionally, the framework of knowledge management higher education has fallen into the bucket of library sciences. Do I think KM is a library science? No, I don't think that. But a lot of schools did because they could see some parallels there. In my view, should be more set in the school of business because it's a business operation, not so much a specific library system kind of concept. There's goodness in both of those worlds. I think what you're speaking of, having the practicality, the grit, the production orientation, the worker mentality, dig in, figure it out, and just get the job done, is a lot of those personal traits that I think everybody wants. But in the formal sense of hiring for a knowledge management role, they got to have those gates, right? They got to have some gates to start saying if you're in or out. And I don't know if it's a bad thing or if it's just an immature thing. Not a mature enough because there's not that many schools that even offer knowledge management
That's right.
higher education. And
Absolutely.
most of the folks we've had on the show that are in a top level position didn't start off in KM. They're all doing all kinds of different things. So there's no direct pathway to follow in a typical career path.
Absolutely.
Nothing's typical.
I do think coming through the legal route gives some kudos when it comes to KM.
Yeah, there's definitely that has that gravitas, if you like.
Yeah,
I started off as a legal
definitely.
secretary and I was bad. I was a terrible legal secretary. I was so bad. Honestly, I can say that hand on my heart. And I say it in job interviews as well. That was where I started. And I think I figured out after a few years that's not what I want to do. So having the knowledge management there really helped me to shape how I would take that forward. But it also made me realize that I don't need to work in a knowledge management role to practice knowledge management. It's as part of
Good point.
but
Good
it's
point.
like the internet is entirely dependent on a strong foundational structure, and that's all about KM, right?
You are just linking in a certain way the legal who are very good in content, to be honest, to knowledge management. You are a content specialist. In which terms you are a content specialist? Because sometimes content specialists can be the new version of the librarian.
Definitely, yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you mean for being a content specialist, and if you see any link with the librarians or maybe with the internet specialists, or better, the intranet specialists, because they know how to search in intranet and portals.
Well, I think that there's a lot of talk in the legal industry that sort of the librarian is a dying breed, but I think that's not true at all. I think it's a role that needs to diversify. Librarians have huge amounts of knowledge about sort of related resources. They really enjoy reading the stuff that no one actually wants to read all of. It's just in their blood. And so they, you know, they're able to say, they'd be able to comment to creating a page. Or, for example, I used to do, as part of the internet manager role at Taylor Wessing, we used to do a budget page, and I know diddly squat about politics, and I would just be like, please help me, you know, what do I need to put on here? And they're so knowledgeable, and that's content. But we're all kind of boxed into our specialisms, aren't we? And there's huge potential for librarians to cross over into that world. And knowledge management is a natural kind of progression to that. I don't think it's a dead profession at all. I think it just needs to be, the narrative around it needs to change.
Monica, you're up.
Well, yeah, it was actually going to be similar to your question, which was how do we kind of see the connection between KM and content, internet, but also communications and the communications, and how important it is to either educate the comms teams on how to manage content better, or work together and partner with comms teams to support them. And what your view on that is, and I know you've worked on both.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think you wouldn't put the two in a room together at all. They're very strange bedfellows on paper, but actually there's a huge interrelationship there. So, and marketing as well, actually, generate lots and lots of content. And it's just the nature of the job to maybe produce two or three sort of news articles a day. Then you've got people across the business putting their kind of content across, and it becomes like a huge melting pot of content. People get overwhelmed. It's well known that people are just, they don't know what channel to go to at the moment, what news to look at. It's, there's just so much. But I think sort of using KM practices, sort of data retention's got a news article, what's its lifespan? You know, who's really going to look at that in a week's time? Is it going to be relevant? Then that kind of gets knocked off. It's a bit like whack-a-mole, isn't it, with content? Just with news, it doesn't have, generally speaking, a huge amount of longevity. And I think comms get quite a bad rap sometimes, but because news is their business, and people are like, well, I don't want to see that. I want to see about the Christmas, you know, jumper photographs, or the trip someone took to another office abroad, where you've got all the pictures of all the colleagues you never see. That's what a lot of people are interested in, or things that affect them directly. News would be much better received if there was a more robust way of managing it. That's where the KM comes into play. I just don't think the two are ever kind of considered in tandem.
I think you're right. From my experience, it's the missing piece for some organisations, where content, that knowledge management manage the content management process.
Yep.
And that they impose an archiving or a harvesting part of their role, educate the rest of the organisation to support that process. And I think sometimes that's a bold move for many organisations, and it's a bold move for a KM person to go, actually, you know, and I do it, and I know I do it. I go up and say, well, this is how long we should be managing this piece of content for. Do you agree? Yes or no? You know, knocking on your door to double check it when the time's up. You know, I would say not all information is made equal. No. It's a bold move for a KM person to start knocking on other departments' doors and saying your content is valued at this.
Absolutely, yeah, it is. And it's, people have, like, people that write content, and maybe communicators would agree, or maybe they wouldn't, but people who write content generally have an attachment to that. If it's something you've created, you maybe put a little bit more importance on it than the consumer. So I don't know if that sort of plays into it, but when you're producing a piece of content and you've got metadata consideration, so what type of content is it, how long should it be on there, it probably helps you to really connect with that bit of content actually consider, do we need this? Could this be part of something else? It makes you think about what you're doing rather than just news article, sling it in, post it. It just gives you that moment to pause and reflect and think about how needed is this? Could this be part of something else?
How sometimes content become obsolete.
Yeah.
People feel emotionally
yes.
attached to that one. Probably it's because they don't want to progress anymore. Depending on several factors, sometimes it's just a matter of power.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's because they are lazy, or sometimes it's because they are tired.
That's it.
Because keeping always update your knowledge base has a cost.
It's an effort as well, isn't it? And it's that part of your day job, you know, sort of auditing content, a bolt-on kind of task that no one wants to do. It's like the ironing at home, right? It's not interesting. It's not sexy at all.
You know, all that kind of wraps around back where we started about librarians, because librarians are in charge of curation.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're actively curating your content, you already have a policy that looks at the value of having this item on the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the old days of having items on a shelf has shifted. Now we talk about how much data do we have and how much do we need and how much storage do we need and how many backups do we need. And that, it's just this ever-expanding mushroom of collection. And I want to bring this to a point. So in your article at Digital Workplace, the content has a carbon footprint. Here's how to tackle the problem. I want you to at least tell the listener what it is that is a cost factor of this unlimited mindset of, oh, we could just fill up the whole world full of ones and zeros. We'll just save everything. There's a part that has to have ownership, and there's a part that has to have authority to tackle that problem.
Absolutely. But we can't just look to the organization for that, because it's the individual responsibility of everyone. And this goes into social media as well. There's a carbon cost for everything we create, like every email that we, you know, reply to just to say thanks. And we Brits do that. You know, it's just endemic to the way that we are. There's a carbon cost to that that nobody thinks about. And I'm actually writing a report on this at the moment. Getting the metrics together is quite challenging, but suffice to say that it's a huge, huge output. You know, the documents that you, say you're, I don't know, creating a document or a PowerPoint presentation, you'll have a number of images. Sometimes they'll look a bit guff, so you need to go back and get another image, or, you know, blow it up, shrink it, stick something on it. And all the while you're sort of iterating different versions, sort of image library, but you never go back and think, you know what, I'm going to get rid of those now. If we were to look at, I think personal devices are an absolute minefield. Funnily enough, I'm going a little bit off piece, had a conversation with someone about how with the Apple devices, if you run out of storage, 79 pence and you can just get yourself another few gigs. And it's actually so easy to do. Rather than go back and do your housekeeping and say, oh, I don't need that, that's a terrible picture, or, you know, that's a WhatsApp gif and whatever, you know, you just think, I paid a 79p, and there's that snowball effect. There's a kind of time constraint on this, because it's not something you'll be paid for, it's not something you'll be congratulated for, recognised for, but it should be part of your everyday job. You create something, then you're responsible for that piece of content, and you've got to take out the trash, because the cost to the planet is absolutely huge. And that, you know, something that I think we'll all be accountable for down the line.
So in an organization, if a person leaves, retires, or goes away, we just delete all their stuff?
Yeah. Well, I think that there has to be that handover period, doesn't there? But, you know, in an ideal world, that would take place, but it generally doesn't. So I think for content owners, you need, well, for a piece of content, you need a couple of owners, maybe three, sort of three people that are responsible for it, rather than just the one person who then sort of vanishes, or God forbid, gets sort of hit down by a number nine bus. You've got dual ownership of the content. And I think, do you know what, it's the spirit in which I write articles as well, but it's, you know, the aspiration. This is what good would look like if we could get there. But actually, we don't really work like that. So we need to find ways of being much more judicious in how we clean up our content, with the caveat that that isn't easy.
What's the carbon footprint of a gigabyte?
No, you got me there. My stats are still, you know, in the works on that. But it's...
Can you get back to us? Because I'm, you know, everything has got a translation. You know, if my automobile produces X amount of pounds of carbon. All right. So that you get that. There's a logical process there, but I think most people are going to have a hard time translating yeah. something they can't really see to something that they really can't see either.
No, do you know what? You're absolutely right. And I attended this this brilliant webinar a little while ago. It was hosted at RPC, which is a law firm. And there were a bunch of different people there. And there was one company called Footprint Digital. So they're an SEO agency with an interest in digital sustainability. And they gave some really interesting sort of stats about how, you know, a YouTube sort of iterations of that, you can go to the moon and back. It was amazing. So I'll dig those out and definitely share them. I should have come prepared with them there. See, this is it. Chaos. No KM in my head. No KM in my head.
All right. We're used to dealing with Monica, so you're fine. Don't worry about that.
I'm like the Kleenex of KM, you know, disposable.
Well, Kleenex is a better analogy than toilet paper.
Oh, thanks.
That's true.
At least I've tagged it with metadata. I think it's absolutely fascinating, this digital sustainability angle. From a KM point of view, I'd never even thought about it because, as you said, it's so easy to mention the word cloud.
Absolutely. And it vanishes, doesn't it? It's off your, yeah, right. off your radar altogether. You know, it's saved and it's constantly saving as well. It's actually such a nuisance when you've made a mistake and you try and go back and it's like, no, we've saved it. That's gone.
That's gone.
Window
yeah,
is closed. It is just incredible how you just don't think about it, but it's there sort of staring you in the face all the time. Some people are really organized with how they manage waste in their household. Mm. Probably not nearly as good as I could be, but they don't think about a lot of their activities from a digital perspective are really costly as well.
Oh, it's interesting. I would like to see the digital vice or comparable to analog. I would have to presume digital's still cheaper as a carbon trade-off than the old style of having steel file cabinets, printed materials, printed all this, binders, shredders, all that stuff that go into that world that we just are still in the bridge from. In a lot of organizations, they still haven't made a digital full transformation. But have you seen any comparable that says, is the digital less than the physical?
No, not really. I mean, to be honest, this is a really niche kind of pocket of sustainability. And the focus really at the moment, and I can say this hand on my heart, I am the only person I'm aware of looking at the digital workplace. Everyone's more kind of focused on the marketing facing, website facing, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And I'm sure the attention will turn inwards. So there's not lots of data out there that have got that like for like. When I come back with the stats, I think it will make a much more compelling case. But as you say, it's very difficult to wrap your mind around it.
From the article that we just mentioned about the carbon footprint, you mentioned that cloud. It says here, you got it from UK Tech News, 7.2 million energy hungry data centers where hundreds of servers require round the clock powering and cooling. And I think that is what we are missing. When we talk about cloud, we just assume it's not in a physical space.
As part of this webinar that I attended, Monica, if your cloud is hosted sort of in a different country, it's got to travel there and back. And that kind of increases the carbon output as well. So it's things that, to be fair, you would never know. You would never think about, whereas say you set up your own sort of website, you wouldn't think, well, where's that hosted? How would you know? It's hard enough just to find a cool name that someone hasn't already pinched. You know, you've now got to find out where your data's hosted. It's that's where organizations should take on that responsibility and help people to understand,
like the cloud, you know, I don't know, like people who own the cloud, Amazon for example, should they be asking us to harvest? A bit like, where are the knowledge managers for Amazon? Where is the knowledge management for cloud? Yeah. Is there no one putting a process in place saying, because you've got here 90% of data, you know, isn't being used, what they're actually capturing?
Microsoft, I'm staggered that they're not doing more, that there isn't more mention of sort of best practice around, you know, they can tell you how long your document retention, or the functionality there for document retention, but they don't explain why it's important other than from a legal standpoint. You've got this document, it might, you know, be out of date. They should really be raising the bar on this. I think it's really disappointing they're not. And don't get me wrong, I love Microsoft, I love all their products, please give me a job one day, but you know, they need to do more.
It's that raising awareness, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
And education,
and they've got this massively, they're privileged in the profile that they've got.
Sure.
It's absolutely global, so it's incumbent upon them. their products are part of the problem, the infinite.
Everybody's chasing the next innovation and the next coolest tool and the next whatever.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. I think there's not enough focus on the conservancy of resources in a digital space, because it's really not, until this discussion that we're having right now, it wasn't forethought in my mind at all.
Yeah.
You know, I don't even consider that a wasteful thing, because I just don't see the connection yet. You know, I'm welcome to understand that better, because I think, as all things, awareness is the first step.
I mean, with a team site, say you create a, you ask IT to create a Microsoft team site for you, you get a whole bunch of stuff with that you might not even need. You get like loads of add-ons and bolt-ons, and most people haven't got a clue how to use SharePoint. Yep. And I say that respectfully, why would they, you know? But it's like, why do we need all this? We don't.
Yeah.
So they could really streamline.
What other industry does that, you wonder? I'm trying to think of another employment that I've had where they just came in and just gave me the world to work with and said, say, good luck, and left. And it's just like most jobs, you got like three things. I got a hammer and I got some nails and I have a saw. You know, very simplistic model, but why would you give somebody way more than they, one, understand how to use? And really, I think there's a repercussion to that, because in my own mind, I'm thinking, oh, I don't know how to use that. Now I feel stupid. You see some good example. You see somebody whip out a pivot table in Excel and you're like, oh my good God, where did that come from? Wow. Those types of skill sets. Is it just the employer just thinks now that everybody should be able to do everything?
Exactly, yeah.
You may expect that, but you can pretty much guarantee that's not ever going to happen.
But I think we're on a slippery slope as well, because with AI and certainly with fever topics, where people still don't understand tagging a metadata and the term store in SharePoint, and they really need to, they're never going to now, because along comes topics and it does it all for you.
They don't have to.
It doesn't necessarily do it brilliantly. It doesn't, you're not taking the time to sit and actually think about, and also canvas opinion. So if you're building your own taxonomy, you're going to go out to the business and you're going to say, how do you define this content? What do you need? And you would go away and you would build this taxonomy based on people that actually know that that sort of knowledge, that embedded organizational knowledge cannot be replicated in AI. But now we're just going to have, don't get me wrong, I think Viva Topics is amazing, but I think it can only be amazing if it's built on top of an embedded taxonomy structure. And people need to understand the benefits of taxonomy, because with more and more people using SharePoint Online now as a sort of editing tool, as a content sort of document repository, they've got to profile those documents to really make the search powerful. But God, it's boring. You know, you've already got to write the page. Now you've got to build all the profile and you've got to fill the stuff in. Most times they don't even know why they're doing it, but they're doing it so that someone can find their content. That's the whole point, right? That's the whole point of creating a piece of content. Someone needs to find it. You want it to have that visibility, and that's why you profile. But most people aren't told that. It's, you know, it's just like, yeah, you got to fill this in. I know, it's a bind, isn't it? You know, SharePoint's rubbish, you know. But there's a whole vibe and a reason to it. And SharePoint may not do aesthetics brilliantly, but by God, it's the most powerful document repository I've ever seen.
I think not. I think it's overrated.
You don't like SharePoint, Jennifer?
I think it's overrated.
Really?
It's absolutely overrated.
I don't know anyone that rates it. I feel like I'm the only person that really likes it, but it's...
I think it's overrated. Yeah. I have the feeling that, honestly, there are better systems to classify and to search. Most of the times they are proprietary, because it depends on the business needs. It's not the employer asking to the employees to be tech savvy.
Yeah.
Is everything outside the company that bring the people to force to be tech savvy. Speaking, they are barely using the VLOOKUP in Excel when they need it. So SharePoint. I think Microsoft team did a brilliant job in marketing, but is this the real tool that all the companies needs to? From a content perspective, SharePoint doesn't work if there is not a taxonomy behind.
Yeah,
and if it's not, the search button is not powerful to search into the immense amount of the documents. I worked for a company where SharePoint was not used. Our repository and internet was much more powerful than SharePoint, and it was totally proprietary. I think it depends on the business needs and on the people needs and the evolution and how much you want to invest in a tool or not. So that's why I'm very skeptical about implementing SharePoint by default.
Yeah, no, that's fair. It's just a cost-effective solution, I think. But then you get someone like marketing involved, and they're very much of the view that, well, the aesthetics aren't amazing on this, so let's buy, you know, a third-party product, throw it over the top. So suddenly now you've got lots of different or lots of extra functionality. But you're right, Janetta. And one thing that is missing sort of across all the contracts I've worked in is there is never an investment in SharePoint training. And it's even worse now that we've gone online, because it's like, yep, it's really intuitive. Off you go. Boom. Here's a couple of videos to watch. And to really understand what SharePoint can do, you need that deep knowledge, and you only get that through training. A developer actually taught me SharePoint, and I mean, God love him, he was the funniest cat. You know, like, developers aren't natural trainers. They're really not. And he's a lovely guy called Sebastian, and I have credited him with my love of SharePoint many times. But we worked together on an intranet project, and, you know, he sort of told me about so much of the functionality, but at a really high level. So, you know, I knew all the, you know, the high end stuff, and then the actual, like, what is a file? What is a list? What can a list do? That was stuff I had to go away and figure out by myself. But there was just no training. So this was rolled out at pace, and there was no one with a really deep sort of SharePoint knowledge to go in and sort of really show people what it can do.
I think also that content, you were speaking about content, and SharePoint content must be curated on a daily basis. So it's not just it's like a window of a shop. Yeah. If it remains always the same, then you pass behind the window only once, and then you don't look anymore at the window. So it's a waste of time, people time, which has a cost.
Absolutely.
Budget cost. So that's a repository. That's what is a SharePoint, a repository. It's a fancy repository, call it as you want, but then there must be some work behind. Honestly speaking, as you say, the taxonomy is the base for most of the content. How many people know what taxonomy means?
None. Well, no, that's not true. But
almost, not none, but almost. So you need to educate them, which is another cost. And then you have to provide the most of the times taxonomy. If you talk to them about tax or keywords, then of course they link this to the taxonomy. So it's a work in progress educating people. And then after all this education, then you can go to maybe a repository, call it SharePoint or whatever you want.
Sure, no, it's very true.
But that's my 2 cents opinion.
And it's really interesting. It's really interesting because I am kind of that SharePoint is kind of my world. It's my bread and butter. So it's interesting to hear the flip side, definitely.
So let's go ahead and move on here. I'm going to do one more piece on SharePoint, and then we'll go around with the burning questions. Everybody gets one last question, and then we'll wrap up.
Cool.
Okay. The art of SharePointing is always difficult because Microsoft builds products that are so deep and so wide, there's nothing easy. But they are extremely thorough if you have somebody that knows all the buttons to push to make it work.
Yeah.
Because we had just rolled out SharePoint 2007, where I used to work. We were just having a ball because there was a lot of stuff that was in the box in business processes that we could experiment with and see if it would be beneficial. But the bad thing was, is that I went to a conference later that year. I saw a demonstration of what SharePoint did for an Air Force command. And I was like, I didn't even know it could do that. What? Ah, because we had no training. They're just like, here's some tools. Go have fun. Most organizations were using a SharePoint as a shared drive. And that was it, storage. They had no idea what it could do. I say that because I took also training on Microsoft's Project. If you've ever worked project management software, Microsoft makes one that is an enterprise level solution that is, my guess, you got to go to school for 2 years to figure out how to make it work. And it's just not user friendly. I mean, it's heavy to the construct, which it needs to be. It's a heavy load to lift. Let's go around burning questions. Let's start in London with our waylaid Red Cross victim with a bad foot, Monica.
Oh, yes. Burning question is about your new report that you're working on. What is it about, and can you tell us when it's out?
Sure. So it's commissioned by the Digital Workplace Group. They're kind of at the cutting edge of all sort of new and upcoming trends. And the focus is on what people's perceptions are of digital sustainability. So people are even aware that their actions in the workplace have a negative impact on the environment. And also, you know, what are the psychological blockers? Because we all have, you know, it sounds like a cop-out, but we are, people are busy and there's so much doom and gloom. And then you come into work and someone's going to say to you, you need to start like cleaning up your local drive there because, you know, you're having a negative impact on the environment. It's got to be framed more positively, but also in such a way that you don't feel like, oh, what, you know, what's my contribution? What difference will that make? It's hardly worth doing. So there's a real collective spirit that needs to be fostered, I think, in organisations around this. So it sort of looks at that. It looks at what other organisations are doing, looks at what some organisations, how they can help. So there's a company called Carbon Literacy Project, which will train your staff on sort of practices or carbon friendly practices. And it looks at, you know, what we can do individually and as organisations, and also how you reward. Reward sounds like, it sounds really patronising, but people, you know, need to feel good about the efforts that they put in. You come into work, you're doing a great job, you're contributing towards the sustainability of the organisation. You should be recognised for that. But I think this will just be the tip of the iceberg stuff, because the metrics around those outputs are not really well defined. And I think, you know, there needs to be more concrete evidence probably to get people, well, some people moving, shall we say.
Thank you. That's super interesting. I can't wait to read it.
No worries. I can't wait to finish writing it.
That's funny. Janetta?
I want to be a little bit provocative on that. So we talk about the librarian, we talk about content, and we talk about creation of the content. And behind these three, let's say, elements, there are people behind. But as you say, the content curation, content curation has a cost and it's boring. And it's also to link it to taxonomy, blah, blah, blah. So let's replace all these people behind, including the recruiting of these difficult people because they are like a niche, with a piece of artificial intelligence like ChatGPT. What do you think?
That is provocative indeed. That's the burning debate at the moment, isn't it? Do you know what? I dipped into it a couple of weeks ago because I was curious. At first I was kind of like, no, not interested. And then I thought, you know what? I'm going to have a look. It does provide you with foundation for something. People have the knowledge. They know how things work in organisations, and they know historical information, they know other people, they can make the content far richer. So I think ChatGPT will give you a reasonable foundation to start from, but it doesn't replace the expertise and the commitment and the emotional connectivity of people. It's absolutely just can't. But that's not denying it's really cool and powerful, and hopefully we'll do some great things in the future, one of which won't be to replace jobs and have my kids cheat on their exams, which is also slightly concerning.
I totally agree with you, Annette, regarding the point. Beside the provocative question, the burning question, otherwise it wouldn't be burning question, I think that the key asset of people that is priceless and you cannot replace it is what you say.
Absolutely.
People passion, people interest.
People make organisations, they make everything that... They make the technology, they feed back on how it works, what doesn't work. You know, people are the key to everything.
Yeah, and they also can provide the food for thoughts.
Absolutely.
And not just a simple answer like 1 + 1 = 2. Yeah, it depends how you created the one for and the other one to have the number 2.
Absolutely.
But it's something that it's only in the people mind. And I think that cannot be replaceable so easily, or at least at all.
No, absolutely not.
My burning question is... What do you define knowledge management
as?
Oh,
damn it. Oh.
So hard.
So hard. It's so hard. I think everyone's got a different view, and I think they tailor that view to fit whatever it is they're trying to achieve, the organisation they're in, the people they work with. But For me, it's the Spanx of the organization. It's the
Thank
big
you.
lady's knickers, Edward. Like, tuck everything in. The foundation. Actually, I'm going to defer to Monica's quote in that KM article where she talked about it as being couture. It's the finishing kind of, well, it's the foundation and it's the finishing touches as well. It's the mechanism.
So what you're saying is it's the spandex of somebody's butt? Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely
Is
not.
that what I'm hearing?
Okay, so
No.
picture the scene, right? Let's think of someone famous. Famous lady. I don't know. If it was a man, I could say Brad Pitt.
Jennifer Lopez.
Okay, nah, Jennifer
Jennifer
Lopez. Now, Jennifer
Lopez. I've heard of
Lopez,
her. Yes.
super fit. She works out, she puts in all the effort, but I bet you she's got a pair of Spanx. And that's what Jennifer Lopez looks amazing because she's wearing her Spanx, right?
Under her couture
It's an
undergarments.
accessory. So you're saying knowledge management is a sexy accessory?
Do you know what? It damn well is going to be sexy. One day it's going to come out, it's going to shake off this fusty persona, and it's going to be so hot. It's going to be so hot, and everyone's going to
So
want
hot.
to
So
get
hot.
knowledge management. But it's what makes something amazing, right? So I'm not saying Jennifer Lopez doesn't have other redeeming qualities, but if you were to just, look at her at the Oscars or something, and the outfit would be amazing. It's all thanks to that foundation stuff, the effort that goes into building that foundation. So yeah,
So it's not an accessory, it's
yeah,
complementary.
absolutely.
It's complementary to the work it's holding.
Exactly. And it's not exclusive from any business area. Everyone should be aware of what it does and how it can make them more efficient. It is a friend to the environment as well. Like, I know that sounds really cheesy, but content design principles, which is really about just providing content that's needed, getting rid of the content that is no longer relevant, that's KM. So these are sort of foundations that support the user experience, but also impact the environment positively. So they're kind of cape crusaders. They're going to be big. I mean, content design's becoming more of a well-known discipline, but it's and it makes so much sense. It's so simple. It's brilliant.
It's so simple, it's brilliant.
I mean, how do we not know it? You read it, you read the definition of content design and think, well, that makes sense. But no sod does
Like,
it,
yeah.
so.
Well, I just want to say thank you for bringing the passion that you apparently are bubbling over with as far as it relates to knowledge management, the dis field of learning and discovery and content development and curation. We want to have you back. You need to tell us
Amazing.
about this next article, and we need to have maybe the folks that you're writing for talk about it too.
I think they would love that. Yeah, definitely.
But thank you, Annette, for being with us. It was a pleasure having you in our show and listening to your opinions and food for thought. So thanks again.
Oh, thank you very much, Ness. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you for having me on. I was so tired. It's like 5 o'clock, well, 6 o'clock here. I was thinking, not exciting. And now I feel all energized. I feel pumped.
All right, Monica, you can say goodbye.
Cup of tea, darling. Cup of tea.
Goodbye. Can we give a shout out for Andrew as
Chop,
well,
chop.
who is the at the end of the ringing bell?
You've been listening to the KM Lobby Show, sponsored by Pioneer Knowledge Services. Thank you for being a part of today's discussions. The music was provided by Monologue Rockstars. The name of that piece was At the Restaurant. The executive producer for this show is Janetta Guelli. Monica, myself, and Janetta, we thank you, and we would hope to have you on to talk about your knowledge management journey.